welcome to Hazel and Katniss and Harry and Star, a young adult literature podcast, their film and television adaptations, and everything in between. I'm Joe.
I'm Brenna.
And our show is located on the ancestral lands of the Haudenosaunee, the Huron-Wendat, and the Anishinaabe on lands connected to the Toronto Purchase, Treaty 13 of 1805.
And on the Tecumloops-Tay-Sequepin territory within the unceded traditional lands of Sequepin Ulu. And today's text, Whale Rider, takes place in Whangarra, Eritrea, which is now known as New Zealand. And this land is the traditional meeting grounds, or Mare, of the Ngāti Porou Nation, or Iwi. In acknowledging this territory, we acknowledge Tangata Whenhu and the importance of the Treaty of Waitangi.
Oh, mm-hmm. I see that this is a very different land acknowledgement from last week.
You know what? I've been doing a lot of reading, a lot of confronting of my own ignorance, I have to say. I think I just assumed that the practices in Australia and New Zealand would be pretty similar.
Oh, yeah, no.
No, they're not at all. And there is no real, like, territorial acknowledgement kind of practice in New Zealand, as near as I can figure, but there is an acknowledgement of the importance of treaty making and recognition of traditional meeting grounds. So, yeah, it's I think what I've just done is like a mashup, hopefully not disrespectful, of our tradition here in North America and what I read about as the tradition in Eritrea.
Okay. Yeah, it's interesting. So I had the opportunity to go to a conference in New Zealand when I was living in Australia. And I have to say that of all of the Commonwealth countries with significant indigenous populations, they have definitely done it the best in terms of acknowledging the Maori, involving them, like really intricately involving them in naming institutions and practices and having like opening ceremonies that are, yeah, just really, really involving the community. And it was really empowering.
Yeah, it was fascinating to me. Like I ended up down several historical rabbit holes. Like, I didn't realize that, you know, Maori people are more genetically connected to like Polynesians and Hawaiians than they are to Australian Aborigines. And like, yeah, it was all new and all fascinating, and learned about Torres Strait Islanders. Like, I've been on a journey since our last New Zealand episode. Yeah, I've learned a lot, and I'm sure I'm still super ignorant because it's been like, you know, a week of reading things on the internet. But
sure.
Yeah, please, as always, listeners, feel free to write in and correct.
And of course, I mean, the reason that we're spending just a little bit more time on this is because, yes, you have done more work, but also because last week's text, which was our introduction to New Zealand month on the podcast, was not involving any kind of indigenous content. It had a white writer. So now we're firmly into it with Whale Rider because, of course, we have an indigenous writer, but not an indigenous filmmaker for the film adaptation.
Yeah, interesting. I think there's criticisms of both texts, and some of them I think are maybe temporally located. Like, so the author is Witty Aihimera, and this book is the most translated work by a New Zealand author ever. Yes. And I think from my research, the first worldwide bestseller by a Maori writer.
Ooh.
And so I think that that's really important. You know, we've talked about the sort of early representation of Indigenous literature in Canada and how the more space you make for more voices, the more kinds of stories can be told. And I think a lot of the criticisms of Whale Rider tend to be about like this sort of, you know, there's sort of like one Maori experience. You don't hear a lot about like the individual community that these characters are from, these kinds of pieces. And I think those are all fair criticisms, but I also think, you know, markets evolve and change and allow more space for more writers over time.
Right.
And I wonder if that's not sort of part of what we're experiencing here.
Yeah. And I mean, we should also acknowledge this is a book from 1987.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah.
Yeah. That temporal piece is very important. Obviously, the other challenge is that we're talking about a text with nearly identical names, but the book is technically The Whale Rider and the film is just Whale Rider, which ended up really annoying me when I was trying to think about how to title this episode. But yeah, I mean, what's fascinating to me too is that, you know, the book, and we'll get into the plot as it were in a moment, obviously very steeped in tradition and myth, purports, yes, to represent the Maori almost as one community. I found it fascinating that Ihamara wrote this when he was living in New York. And it's almost like I wrote this for my daughter because I wanted her to be connected to where she came from. But also it's like a bit of a fable. It's a bedtime story in a way.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, it's a rewriting of the sort of Maori story of Pikea, who is the whale rider. That's the story that gets like echoed back through this story, of course, with this different gendered approach, right? Which is really what the book is about. The book is about, like, can a girl with so much potential find a place to extend her capacity for leadership within this community that is so strongly patriarchal?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that's where the interest in tradition comes into play, right? I mean, I'll confess, this is where I butt heads with my gap in information or knowledge about the Maori. Like, I don't know if they are an inherently patriarchal society, but I would reason to guess, based on the genesis of the tale, that it probably is, right? Like, the line of succession is passed down by male chiefs, and that's where our story, you know, finds a lot of its conflict.
Yeah, so the basic plot is that we have a narrator, Rauiri, who's like, he's the uncle of this protagonist. And it's really interesting how his character gets kind of sidelined in the film, because I love him in the book. Like, he's this very cool, like, motorcycle driving, like, cool guy, who also becomes this really important mentor and caregiver in the life of our true protagonist, who is this little girl named Pikea. So basically, we have a chieftain who we know as Koro, and he is waiting for his first grandson to be born because he will be the natural future leader of the community. But lo and behold, we end up with a girl instead. Not only a girl, but her mother dies in childbirth or shortly after. And so we have this girl who ends up being like unclaimed by her father's community, except for her grandmother and her uncle, who like know about her close connection to this community. They actually bury her placenta or her umbilical cord in the land so that she will always be drawn back to this place.
Right.
And over time, she tries to be the grandson that Koro always wanted, right? She's always trying to like tell the stories the way the boys do and do the dances and learn the songs and like be sort of the Maori grandson that her grandfather really wants. But he's blinded by her gender, really. Yeah. He can't see her potential and her capability. What we learn is that not only is she attuned to all of the tradition that means so much to her grandfather, but she's actually inherited this mythical ability to speak to the whales. And so, you know, she tries to kind of help with the revitalization of the community, but she's always spurred back by her grandfather. And so eventually she takes matters into her own hands. And when all of these whales beach themselves, which is one of, it's so beautiful in the book. Like, it's a shame. There's no way for the film to do it justice.
No.
But it's so moving and like graphic and violent and visceral. These whales dying on this beach. And she sort of whispers to the leader of the whales and says that she's the re-embodiment of his rider and helps to lead the whales back out into the ocean safely and almost dies in the process.
Yeah.
And it takes all of that for her grandfather to realize that she is something special.
It's like, oh man, the lengths that this girl has to go to. Because we've not said in the book, she's 8 years old.
Yes, she's a girl, like a little girl.
Also interesting to note that the book and the film is famous for the whale beaching sequence. And this is actually based in historical facts. So Ihamara saw this. It was 60 sperm whale ended up washing up on Wainu Beach on March 18th of 1970. So like a lot of that visceral impact that you get from the book is based on experiences he witnessed and observed. Like even the like the white folks singing the religious song. That was all based in fact, apparently.
And it's such a fascinating scene in the book because you have these, like, basically these white poachers who come along, and, like, while the whales are still slowly dying on the beach, they're, like, cutting parts off. It was hard to read. I had to put the book down.
Oh, it's gross.
It's so gross. And then at the same time, you've got this, like, religious community that's trying to sort of keep them away, and these elders and these, like, white elders who are, like, banding together. It's a fascinating scene that where you learn so much about the community. Of course, in the film, it's primarily about Pekea and her moment. So we don't have as much of that kind of community coming together sort of stuff. But it's a fascinating scene in the book. And, like, genuinely, I think maybe one of the most, I don't know, visceral, I keep coming back to that word, but, like, emotionally, like, raw moments we've read on the show in a long time.
Yeah, just really, really impactful, because it feels like this is a very short book. Super fast read. And we've not talked about some of the, I don't want to call them bracketing devices, because that's not quite right, but we are getting the legend and the myth of the original Pai or Pika. So that's the original whale rider, but it's told from the experience of this elder whale. And, you know, it's really telling about the origins of the indigenous community. Like, how did they come to settle on New Zealand? And, you know, what happens after the great whale rider sets up a population, a community, and kind of leaves the friendship with the whale behind. We'll get into that in a moment, but this book is so short, but it feels inevitable. Like, you know something awful is coming, because that's why Koro is so desperate to find the next generational leader, because he can feel the community dying out. He can feel the traditions dying away. And so you know that there's going to be, like, something has to happen. There has to be some kind of sign. And it all culminates in this big storm with all the beached whales. It's just, it's so vivid.
It is, but it's also so frustrating as a read, because for everything you've just articulated, right? Like, we know that something is coming. We know that the community is in trouble. We know that, you know, Koro can't, like, convince any of the young people to take his tradition seriously. He's constantly having to, like, reinvent new ways to connect with them, establish new, like, schools, doing all these kinds of things. And the whole time you're like, she's right there.
Staring you in the face, old man.
Oh my God. From the moment she bites your toe while you're literally telling the myth about the guy biting the toe. Oh my God.
But I think that's why the Nanny Flowers character is so important. So Koro has this really outgoing, opinionated wife. And, you know, she is Kai's biggest defender. You know, she wants this relationship to happen between grandfather and granddaughter. And, you know, she has this repeated refrain where every day she says, I'm going to divorce you because I can't stand the way that you act. And, you know, you bother me so much. And that fiery passion is comedic, but it also reinforces just how misguided and close-minded Koro is.
Yes, absolutely. Because it's constantly being reinforced. It's not like, oh, one day he finally hears, like, no, people are yelling at him all the time. Like, everybody's trying to communicate to him that he's missing something important.
Yeah. Which is fascinating, right? Because in some ways, his situation is really dire. Like, he's trying to protect these old ways, but in doing so, he's actually closed himself off to how things can move forward while still maintaining the connection to the land, to history, to tradition.
Yeah, I get it. And also one of the most frustrating characters we've read so far.
Oh, for sure. For sure.
And I think it's because the book does such a good job of showing you, like, who the real chosen one is here. Mm-hmm. And of course, there's, like, such an interesting message here, right? About how, like, misogyny and a set way of looking at things and an inability to see people as people outside of their archetypes makes it actually impossible to move forward, even for someone who knows that the community needs, like, change and refreshing.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's circle back around to the mythology piece. So, you know, we've got the contents organized by season. So it's spring, summer, autumn, winter, and then we've got a prologue and an epilogue. But each of these sections open with the mythology of the story and what happened to the whales and so on. And I was interested, what did you think of this different perspective? Because in some ways, again, in my mind, I was having a conversation of, is this YA? Is this even middle grade? Because sure, our protagonist is 8 years old, but it's not even her telling the story. It's an adult man. And then we've also got this ancient whale who's providing the other side of the story.
Yeah, I think this one is really challenging to classify. I think, you know, the film makes a more explicit move for this to be her coming of age as much as it is anything else. But I think it's difficult. I really love the whale's point of view, I have to say. Like, I think that it's fascinating how explicitly clear the whale's voice is, if that makes sense. Like, I mean, they're offset by italics. Like, you know, you're not reading sort of the plot proper. You know, you're reading this kind of framing, contextualizing piece. And it often parallels moments of upheaval within the community. So we get one like right before the birth, and we get one right before the whale beaching, and we get one right before the body is found. So that there's every time something big is going to happen in the community, we are signaled to it by these passages from the perspective of the whale. And so I really like it as a storytelling device. Like, I found it very compelling. It worked really well for me. I kind of missed it a little bit. Like, I don't know how you would ever do that in a film, but like, there's something really, there's something that really takes you out of your expectations of realist fiction, you know, when you're reading the perspective of a literal whale. Right? And I like that.
And even as I was describing it as kind of like fairy tale or mythology, I was hesitant to do so because I was very cognizant and thinking back to our conversations about Eden Robinson and how she really hates when people use the term magical realism to describe her writing. And I don't want to fall into that same category, but there is something epic in scope. In, like, it's a real ballsy move to write from this perspective and intersperse it, but particularly in the way that it has these linkages to Indigenous peoples in Canada, where so much of it is about, you know, grounding your story in the cycles of nature and animals and just almost acknowledging human beings are only one part of the story. And I really liked how that was almost a united piece that we could say, oh, we've seen this in Canadian Indigenous literature and texts, but also we're now seeing it in New Zealand.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? Because it reminds you that there is like this older way of telling stories and narrativizing our world that like exists so far beyond the European traditions that you and I were like actually educated in. And so I don't think it's wrong to see those like connections across those kinds of storytelling. But yeah, I had the exact same experience. So I have one question for you. So in the book, we have this period of sort of fallow in the text, right? Where our protagonist is actually being raised by her mother's community. So she's not connected to the community at all during this period, or at least not like part of it. She goes for summer vacations for a few months, spends time with her dad. And during this period, her uncle goes on this like sort of self-discovery journey where he goes to Australia and works for a while. Finds out that even when he's in Australia, all he really does is hang out with Maori people who he finds there. And like, and then he takes this work contract in Papua New Guinea. And that scene, that the series racism of scenes, the racism is wild. And it's really interesting to me because, so basically, there's this assumption that the Indigenous people of Papua New Guinea, Melanesians, actually what they're called, they call them Papuans in the book, that they're cannibals, right? Like, that's where the like root of the racism is coming from, right? That like these people can't be trusted because of this. And so the white people who he's working for in New Guinea, they sort of see him as like this go-between, right? Like, he's not quite 100% trustworthy because he is pretty brown, but at least he's not one of the
kind of brown.
And there's this scene where they hit and kill an Indigenous person mm-hmm. on the road, somebody who like has worked for them.
I was going to say, it's someone they freaking know.
They know but him.
But the white estate owner just is insistent that they continue driving because it was his own fault. What was he doing walking on the side of the road?
Yeah. So he's like, we have to leave. And Larry's like, no, like, I'm going to go see if he's okay. And then they're immediately all like, they're going to kill you. Like, you're going to get cannibalized by these people. They're not trustworthy. And meanwhile, like, this guy is maybe not even dead on the road. He's just like mm-hmm. lying there. They don't do anything to help him.
No. And he dies.
And he dies. And then interestingly, like, that's his last straw. He's like, I don't want to hang out with white people anymore. They're terrible. Yep. I'm going back to New Zealand. I'm going back to my community. But he gets there and like, his family is like super racist about the indigenous people of Papua New Guinea as well. Like, they're like, oh, you didn't come back. Like, did you eat people? Like, did you see them eat people? It's like, it's wild to me. So those scenes are really fascinating. They also have basically nothing to do with the central narrative. And so I'm just wondering, like, why do you think they're there, Joe? Because they're really confronting scenes.
I agree with you. Yes, they're very, very confronting. I can't help but wonder if part of this is to broaden the discussion or the analysis of an indigenous experience. Like you mentioned earlier that the book has received criticism for painting the Maori people as a single-minded group. And of course, like we know living in Canada, even I've done it here on this very podcast in this episode, saying like, oh, the indigenous people in Canada, as though there aren't multiple different kinds of tribes and peoples. And I can't help but wonder if this is like, oh, you know, we inherently do this to ourselves, or we are simultaneously racist against other people. Like, just because you're a member of a marginalized group or a community doesn't mean that you're going to be more welcoming or more open-minded about others.
Yeah, it's almost like we can't help it, right? Like, if there's an other to be othered, then even people who are currently being othered will other.
Yeah. Like, others gotta other.
And it's fascinating because it's almost like the only person who can see all of this clearly is Rawiri, because he's the one who's had the multiple experiences. Like,
Well, and he had to leave his community to discover that, right? I think it's another example of the sort of closed-mindedness of, you know, when you insulate and you kind of hunker down and keep your head within like-minded people, you're going to propagate the same ideas over and over again.
And nobody understands why he wants to go, right? It's this whole sense of like, why on earth would you want to go and see what else is out there?
Right.
And yet, yeah, he's the character through whom we get the perspective of like, wow, like everybody's got some work to do. Like, wow.
Shall we transition over to the film and talk about some of the differences?
Yeah, let's do.
A long time ago, my ancestor Paikia came to this place on the back of a whale. Since then, in every generation of my family, the firstborn son has carried his name and become the leader of our tribe.
And then Spike?
No. Not that name.
Until now.
When she was born, that's when things went wrong for us.
I'm gonna need all the firstborn boys.
That's where we'll find the answer.
This will be a sacred school of learning. You'll be taught in all the qualities of a chief.
Oi, go to the back.
How come you won't let you do it?
Girls aren't allowed.
Make your enemies feel the fear.
He's got a lot of rules he has to live by.
It's not fear.
Keep her away. It's distracting for the boys.
That old pucker's not the only one who knows some tricks.
Could you teach me?
Yes.
You will be tested for your strength.
Good.
Your courage. And your leadership.
But there can only be one.
What have you done? You knew this wasn't for you.
I'm sorry, Paka.
You don't mess around with sacred things.
Why doesn't he want me?
He's just looking for something that doesn't exist anymore.
A new leader. They exist.
Okay, so Just Whale Rider comes out in 2002. It is written and directed by a white filmmaker named Nikki Caro. And we have the following cast. So we have Keisha Castle Hughes as Kahu or Pai. This is her breakout role. You know, she beat out about 10,000 other kids to get this. Oscar-nominated performance, so I think it kind of worked out for her.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we have Ruwiri Paratene as Koro, Vicky Houghton as Nanny Flowers, Cliff Curtis as Pai or Kahu's father, Purungani. We have Grant Roa as Ruwiri, that's her uncle. Rachel House as Shaiho, that's Ruwiri's girlfriend, although she would be just as interested in going after her father. And then we have, finally, Mana Tamanu as Hemi. That's the boy who is taking Korra's classes that hopes to become the next chief, and he ends up helping Kahu.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so what are your thoughts on the film? Because you reference off the top that there's some key differences that make this feel simultaneously very similar and yet distinctly its own entity.
You know, all the plot points match, like all the major plot points match, but there's a couple of things that are really significant differences, I think. So one is the fact that we actually have the focalization entirely through Paikea's character here. Like, she is telling this story literally from a voiceover in the first moments of the film. It is always her perspective that is prioritized. So that's a pretty huge difference. The other difference, it's almost like they wanted to make Koro seem more, I don't know, sympathetic almost, because
a little more likable.
They do a lot of work to make it so that it's actually like Paikea is like pushing too hard, or like, I don't know. So from the beginning, she's not born and then her mother dies immediately after. She is born a twin.
Yeah.
And her brother dies, and then her mother dies. But this brother would have been the the next chief, right? And so in the book, it's an entirely fictional boy who doesn't exist, who Koro is waiting for, right? And that makes him all the more infuriating, because you're just like, my dude.
What are you waiting for?
Like, come on. Whereas here, there's like almost this mourning that's wrapped up in Koro's feelings about Paikea. So that's one thing that I think is importantly different. And the second thing is that, like, he actually is a really great grandfather for, like, the first third of the film.
Yeah.
They're very close.
Yeah, he just doesn't want to consider her for chief or to do any of the traditional practices, because that's for boys, that's for men. But he still loves her as his granddaughter.
Yeah, because in the book, like, he won't even look at her. He won't play with her. He won't smile. He hates her. Whereas here, he's actually, like, he's a very loving grandfather right up until the moment when her father convinces her to go with him to Germany. Oh, by the way, he's an artist and he travels the world and he has a white wife with another child. It's very different.
A different invention. And I like that. That felt like not a one-to-one, but similar to what Ruwiri experiences in the book, where it's like you had to leave the community, and then it's how do you find your way back? Are they still your people? And that kind of tension.
Yeah, and I also just think it was convenient to get Purungi out of the way, right? Because this is really just a story between grandfather and granddaughter. Like, Nanny Flowers obviously matters too, but, like, that's who the focus of this story is. There's no dad getting in the way.
Right.
So the other thing that I think is really significant is that she screws up a lot in the film, right? Like, her desire to please her grandfather means that, you know, she's always trying to, you know, learn to fight with the way the boys do, learn the dances, learn the songs, but she's forever messing up in ways that are a lot more explicit or clear, I think, to a non-Maori audience. Like, it's obvious to me when she breaks the staff that that's a problem, right? It's obvious to me when she's in these spaces where she shouldn't be that that's a problem. Whereas in the book, it's often hard to figure out what it is she's doing that's pissing off Koro so much.
Okay.
And so I think all of this makes Koro much more sympathetic in the film, which is probably wise for a film, because you guys spend a lot of time with this guy and you don't want to just hate him the whole time.
Yeah, they've also made the decision to age her up. So she's about 12 in the film, whereas I think if they had kept her young and then kept him so mean, it would have like veered into near child abuse.
Yeah, it's true.
So, as you said, yeah, a lot of similarities mapping one-to-one. You know, we still get the beaching scene. We get him skipping her recital where she won for a poem that was all about how great he is. So
that scene is heartbreaking.
Yeah. And you know, I'm not going to lie. I don't entirely feel that Castle Hughes is revelatory in the way that we were talking about this performance 20-something years ago. Mm. I think she's great. But in some ways, I almost walked away from the film thinking that it was a fairly traditional coming-of-age film. Like, I didn't find it as moving or even as immersive as I found the story. And I can't help but think that it was something I thought of just as you were talking. This feels more palatable to white audiences.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was made really for us. Maybe it was made for an international audience. We should note that it was hugely successful. So it had an approximate budget of $3.5 million and it grosses $41.4 million. And as I said, Oscar attention, you know, all of these good things. So this really puts, to a certain extent, Maori culture on the map, and it gives us this breakout star. So in some ways, I think a lot of these decisions were wise, but having read the story, this does feel... watered down sounds really mean, but it feels simpler.
Well, I think some of the things that we talked about in the book, like the both brave and surprising choice mm-hmm. to have chunks of the book narrated by this whale, like...
I don't know how you would do it.
No, and I don't think you could. Like, I think you would pretty much have to... Those segments would probably have to be animated for that to be possible. But, like, because they're not there... And because there's not any sort of equivalent, like, remarkable storytelling choice here happening, we go from a book that is very much centered in a non-Western worldview that doesn't reflect other books that we've read, Joe. Like, it's mm-hmm. different from the tradition that, as I said earlier, like, it's different from the tradition they were educated in. But that's not the case with the film, right? As you said, it's right. a very straightforward coming-of-age story. And I think that... While I'm not sure how you would have made a different choice with the film, I think doing that does exactly make this a more palatable story, an mm-hmm. easier story to tell and to show, but you lose a lot of what feels so different, magical, exciting about the book.
Right. Now, to be clear, we're not advocating along the same lines as the absolutely terrible Slant article that is linked in the show notes. So this is a review that takes the film to task, I'm pretty sure, by someone who doesn't even realize that it's based on a book, because they basically describe it as a Maori version of The Karate Kid. And
one of the worst film reviews I've ever read, Joe.
It's awful. It's like, honestly, as a film critic, I was appalled. Just, it's terrible. It's short. It doesn't do the film any justice. But, you know, what I struggled with, like, I read it, I laughed, I wrote it off, and then I went back to it and thought, I think the film in some ways is almost making it easy for people to misinterpret it because it is adhering to these more traditional lines. Like, it does feel like something that we have seen before. It's just infusing a slightly different culture in it. And maybe this is me not being generous enough to the film. Like, we should note that Nicky Caro got a certain amount of backlash within, like, New Zealand. So there's another link in the show notes from Stuff. It's an interview done by Michael O'Sullivan, who talks to her about this backlash. And essentially, there was an editorial in a Maori publication called Mana, and they took her to task for, you know, you're a white person, or what they call a pakaha, and she shouldn't have been telling that story. And it really ended up upsetting her. Like, in the interview, she talks about how she went to Wangara, which is where the book is set. It's where they shot the film. She lived in the community with the people. They adopted her as a kind of chief that enabled her to tell the story. So I think that these are really interesting pieces, because in some way, yeah, we're back to having a discussion of, should a white person be telling a Maori story? And what does due diligence look like? But then also, did she take it so far that she's made a film that white people can look at and say, oh yeah, I totally understand it. It just happens to have this sprinkling of Maori culture in it.
Well, yeah. And I think, you know, we've talked about this before. There's not like one single sort of right way to approach this kind of task, and everybody feels differently about it. But
sure,
you know, it's interesting. So my biggest complaint, such as it is, because I did enjoy the film, and I think it's important to note, like, it's a very pleasurable watch.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And it is moving in moments. It's not as moving as the book. Like, like I cried during the whale scene in the book. I did not in the film.
No, it's actually just like a visually impressive moment in the film where you think, oh, wow, how did they actually do this? Because it looks great, but it doesn't have that same tug on your heartstrings element.
No, but then I also read, like, so Roger Ebert's review of the film at the time was, the genius of the movie is the way it sidesteps all of the obvious cliches of the underlying story and makes itself fresh, observant, tough, and genuinely moving. And I don't agree. In fact, I don't think it sidesteps any of the obvious cliches in the underlying story. And I don't mean that in a bad way. Like, the film isn't like a horrible cliche from moment to moment to moment, but it is, as you've already said, Joe, like, in many ways, a pretty bog standard coming of age story set against a backdrop of the Maori culture.
Yeah. Like, how much of this is ignorant white critics and maybe audiences saying, well, I'm not going to say something bad about this because I don't understand it well enough. So I'm going to praise it as though it is really breaking new ground. And I think it is in terms of the depiction, because, you know, when you look at the film, this is an entirely Maori set cast.
Yeah.
But for the most part, you know, what you're seeing on screen is something that particularly in North America, haven't seen a ton of. Now we have, you know, in the 20 plus years since this film came out. But it was breaking new ground in that way. And I wonder how many white audiences were like, I'm not going to say something because I don't want to come off looking like I have a boot stuck up my butt.
Or for how many of those audiences, just the fact that they were looking at Maori people was fresh and new, right? Yeah. Like, there is a sense that, you know, from the perspective of introducing audiences to a brand new group of actors they wouldn't have been exposed to previously.
Right.
That maybe that was enough for it to feel not cliched. And we've talked about this before, right? Like, when we read a sort of a bog standard rom-com, but the characters are people we haven't read in those situations before, sometimes that is enough for it to feel reinvented. Maybe that's kind of what Ebert's getting at here. And 20 years on, we don't see that anymore. And that's a good thing. Like, that's also possible.
Ooh, you know what? I like that, because that's a silver lining read that makes it seem like, as a society, we've actually advanced a little bit.
Fingers crossed.
Sometimes I don't always believe that myself. Yeah,
same.
Do we want to talk a little bit at all about that climactic moment on the beach with all of the whales? So this is practical. So the effects were done by Glasshammer FX. They, I think, built about 8 whales.
Oh, wow.
And I think this looks so fantastic for the budget. Like, these whales...
they look real. Yeah, they do.
And there's that really horrifying moment where she has to, you know, climb up on one and it takes her out into the water. And I just thought, I am scared for this little girl. Mm-hmm. So in that capacity, it does really work. It doesn't have that same catharsis. Like, it doesn't feel like real world intersecting with Maori myth and legend like the book does, where it feels like the two halves have finally come together and Coral has to admit something. Here it's like, okay, yeah, you know, she got there, like, good on her, girl. But just the actual image of a girl on a whale that looks so authentic was pretty cool.
So I think part of it is that because we don't have that whale point of view, which we've already talked about, we don't even know how they would do, so it's maybe not a fair criticism, but without that whale point of view, she rides a whale. That whale leads the other whales out of the situation that they're in. But there isn't the kind of explicitly spiritual, like, death and rebirth that happens in the book, right? No. Like, there's a way of watching this film where you don't have any engagement with the spiritual message at all, right? Like, this is just a girl who took a risk. She helped the whale. Then she almost drowned. Now she's okay at the end.
Yeah. Exactly.
Which is not at all what happens in the book, right? In the book, no. Like, she's underwater for a long period of time. She's talking to this whale. The yeah. whale realizes she's not the right guardian. She has to explain herself as, like, the next generation. The mm-hmm. women whales have to come to her defense yes. because, again, even the whales are so patriarchal and bullheaded that they don't see what's going on. The
I love that there's, like, a Nanny Flowers whale equivalent. It's yeah. so it's so good.
It's so good. And, like, she is basically dead at this point, right? Like, she has been yeah. underwater for a long ass time. And then the whale decides to return her back to the community so that she can continue the good work now that he knows that he's not been forgotten by her people.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's so beautiful.
It's beautiful. It's spiritual. It's like, it's interconnected with this whole history and mythology and faith.
Mm-hmm.
And we get zero of that in the film.
Yeah. Yeah, like how she turns back up, it's just, oh, she's in the hospital and she's okay. And, you know, Koro recognizes that she was able to go down and get his pendant that he had dropped in the water that none of the boys had been able to recover. And as a result, yes, she is finally the natural successor. And it works. It mm-hmm. works within the world of the film. But when you know what is missing, I mean, you said it earlier. I think the only way to have done it would be animated. And I'm not going to lie. For as good as this film is, and for as good as Castle Hughes's performance is, I think I would love to see a remake of this in purely animated form.
Yeah, me too. I really would, especially with how far animation has come in the last 20 years and what's possible. Like,
mm-hmm.
it could be really exquisite. And
especially if it's like Maori artists who are mm-hmm. using like their sort of way of representing things, like, I think it could be really beautiful.
Yeah, and it's a layer that's missing from the film that takes us back to this idea that, like, this film is for a broad and primarily non-Maori audience.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the book never worries about whether
no.
we're going on the spiritual journey or not, because the book is going there.
Like, well, and it's also just, it feels like it was written for Ihamara's daughter.
Yeah.
And the rest of us just get access to it.
Yeah, exactly. And it's you come to it with a willing heart or you don't. It's like whatever. Whereas, mm-hmm. you know, the film is very much interested in telling a story that is about this one girl's growing up and very much yeah. less interested in this question of like what it is for a community to be spiritually healthy, which the book is very interested in. Like, what does mm-hmm. spiritual health look like for yeah. colonized people? Like, that's central to what's going on in the book. And mm-hmm. the film, whether no. because the filmmaker is not herself part of this community or what, can't tell that story.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fascinating, right? Because normally we would look at a film of this caliber as like, oh, it's a low budget film, you know, because it's regional, it's not being made within the Hollywood studio system, so it can tell its own story the way it wants to. And I do think if you ask Kara, like in the interview, she's so happy with this film. She feels like it was embraced by the right people. So I don't want to diminish any of these accomplishments, but it does feel like in some ways it's still art that's been slightly compromised to appeal to that international mass market audience. And in some ways, we're not capturing everything that the story could be telling so that we can get to that $40 million international gross.
Yeah. And, you know, it's doing other things, right? It's representing people who would not have been, you know, would not have been seen by, like, Hollywood mm-hmm. critics without the existence of this film. Like, it's doing something else that can also
Absolutely.
Be productive and positive.
Yeah. You know, you said it before we hit record, but, like, this is possibly one of the strangest adaptations we've seen, because in some ways it's so successful on its own, and yet it is completely different to the book, and yet it also is tracking almost one-to-one directly in terms of adaptation decisions. Like, this is such an interesting and slightly confusing conversation to have had.
Yeah, agreed.
It's basically just Karate Kid.
That review is one of the worst things I've ever read.
It's awful. Burn it with fire.
Oh my gosh. Do you want to do bingo?
We can try.
Okay.
Bingo!
Not a good bingo.
All right. So, yeah, great question. Thanks for asking. So we definitely have borrowed time. I would say
yes.
more so, I mean, it's more explicit in the film because, like, you do get this sense that eventually her father's going to want her to come. And, like, she's sort of got this window of time where she's, like, trying to make her grandfather see who she is. And also, once the whales dry up on the beach, then we're all on a big old borrowed time clock.
100%. So. And it's interesting, too, in the film, we go the sort of, ooh, let's not be Debbie Downer, where all of the whales survive. Whereas in the book, all them whales die.
All them whales is dead. Mm-hmm. It's hard. We have a road trip in both. It's Rory's road trip in the book, and it's an almost road trip for our protagonist in the film.
Mm-hmm.
I think that her grandfather's abusive to her in the book, at least emotionally.
Oh, so much emotional abuse for sure.
Like, man. Obviously, we have a chosen one.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know. What do you have?
Okay. So I have a dead body for the film because the specter of her twin brother hangs over the relationship that she has with her grandfather.
Yeah.
I have coincidental classes because in both book and film, we do get to see quite a lot of Koro's teaching. Mm-hmm. You could argue whether it's truly coincidental because he's very deliberate with what he's trying to achieve. But in terms of advancing the plot, giving us that almost conventional, ooh, okay, this is where we learn what we need to do in order to become the person we're meant to be. Like, it does feel like, oh, everybody open your Shakespeare novel so that we can comment on what's happening in the plot.
Yeah, I'll allow that.
I do have aged up because, of course, we go from 8 to 12. It's a minor. It's like a baby aged up.
Well, but 8 to 12 is a big gap in terms of what you expect and capacity and all those kinds of things.
Like, Kahu is her own person in the film, whereas there's points where you think, this is a child and she needs to be protected in the book. Like, maybe don't let her out of your sight.
Yeah. Stop letting her run around. Keep an eye on her.
We do, of course, get a lovely montage of Save the Whales in the film.
Mm-hmm. We have a female director.
Yes. The only other one that I had, and this is where I get back into the tricky, icky Eden Robinson of it all. Do we call this magic supernatural?
I think it is certainly supernatural in the definition of other than the world that we see in front of us.
Mm-hmm.
That is my respectful way of giving us credit on the board, while also acknowledging that, you know, these are truly held beliefs for people.
Yes.
And referencing them as magic is perhaps not the most respectful.
Yes. You said that so much more eloquently than I ever could have.
Thanks.
Needless to say, we nearly got there. We needed either a sexual awakening or a perfect date, and this text is giving us neither of those things.
No, and honestly, thank goodness.
Yeah, not appropriate. No place for it.
No. Well, Joe, we are continuing New Zealand, or should we say Eritrea, month next week with Flight of the Albatross by Deborah Savage, which, folks, we are reading on the Internet Archive because we can't get copies of it. So please feel free to read along with us and enjoy our pain.
And I will say, this is one worth checking out. It's, again, an older text. It does have a film adaptation, but unfortunately, I cannot find a copy. Like, not even a paid copy.
This isn't us being cheap.
No, like, it seemingly does not exist outside of archives in New Zealand, which is really frustrating because I'm enjoying the book and I want to see how they've captured it on film.
Yeah, it's a bummer in this case. But if you maybe have access to it somehow, you should definitely write in and tell us about it. And if you wanted to do that, you could find us on social media at HKHSPod or on the hashtag HKHSPod. Joe, where do they find you?
I can be reached at B Stole My Remote, and that's the letter B.
And I'm at Brenna C. Gray, that's Gray with an A. And of course, for anything long form, email is the best mail. And no, it's not, but we like it. And you can send it to hkhspod@gmail.com.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think I'm glad we did this one, Joe. You know, it's one of those things that, like, everybody has seen Whale Rider except you and I.
Right.
So it was about time we got to it. But I really hope that people who liked the film back in 2002 when it was everywhere will take time to seek out the novel because it is really worth your time.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And just as we're closing out, I should also thank Laura from Germany, who did, in fact, alert us that this is a title she wanted us to cover. And we coincidentally had just happened to program this block. So, Laura, I hope we did it justice or that you enjoyed the episode.
Yeah. Awesome. Thank you for suggesting it. And don't forget to write in with other suggestions. We're happy to hear them.
Mm-hmm.
So until next time, I will see you on the page.
And I will see you on the screen. And everything in between. I'm Joe.
I just totally meant to say I'm Joe.
I love that for you. Let's swap places.
I'm Brenna.
Okay, but you have to stop laughing because it's not going to make any sense in the edit.
So Rauriri goes on like, no, not him. It's Kahu. Yeah. So in the book, Kahu mm-hmm. goes on this little, no, it's Rauriri. Okay, I'm sorry. Hang on.
You're fine.
It's almost like the only person who can see all of this clearly is
And I guess the only other thing that I had was, maybe I don't feel that. I'm going to take that one off the board.
Well, Joe, we are continuing New Zealand Week next.